This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm David Remnick, and this is a special episode of our podcast. This summer, the Public Theater in New York is putting on Shakespeare's play, Richard II. Now, normally, of course, they'd be doing it for free in Central Park, but it was canceled. So Richard II is happening instead on the radio and on podcast in four episodes. The New Yorker's theater critic Vincent Cunningham hosts the event, and you don't have to stand in line for 8 hours in the sun to get tickets. Richard II is about a weak, indecisive king who loses control and faces a rebellion by his cousin. Andre Holland plays Richard, and he talked with Vincent Cunningham.
As the host of this radio production, I interviewed a number of the principal actors in the show, and I was especially excited to talk to Andre Holland. You might remember him from the great movie Moonlight, and he was also the lead in a movie I loved so much called High Flying Bird. He's a wonderful presence on screen, a wonderful voice. And the casting of this production was really unusual. Most of the principal actors are Black people and people of color. And this was all decided well before we knew that it couldn't happen in the Delacorte Theater and instead would have to happen on radio. And so much of the complication, much of the challenge of making the production was having the sort of color consciousness that is so much a part of the public's mission often with Shakespeare and making it come across in terms of sounds instead of sights. So one of the things that Andre and I talked about a lot is performing Shakespeare as a Black actor.
It really spoke to me, man. The language really moved me, and it sounded so much like people who I had grown up around, you know what I mean, in Alabama. And I just felt really connected to it. You know, there's a rhythm to the language that it can sound, I think, at worst, sort of repetitive and boring, but I think really what he was trying to do was write the way that human beings speak and think. And, you know, when I think about Black people in the South, you know, we kind of naturally speak in this like iambic pentameter kind of way at times. Mm-hmm. Like when I speak to my pops, for example, you know, I call down and, you know, how you doing, man? How, you know, how's your day going? He might say, I can't kill nothing and look like won't nothing die, you know? And so when I hear, you know, when I read Shakespeare and it sits in me in a cool way. And there's a lot of people who say that actually the way that the Elizabethans would have spoken Shakespeare is very, very, very close to the American South, the sound of the American South, mm-hmm. you know? So I think it just sits in my mouth in a cool way. I think it just fits. I feel at home in it.
Yeah. Was that instant?
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, you know, it felt like it was this thing that was kind of held up, right? Shakespeare was a thing that you had to do or aspire to if you wanted to be a good actor or be thought of as a good actor. And at the same time, it was often presented as this thing that you had to, you know, quote unquote, elevate yourself to. People would say that in school, you know, you have to elevate yourself to meet the language.
Wow.
And I always found it to be kind of problematic. although I didn't have a language to express why, it didn't feel right. You know what I mean? It probably wasn't until like my senior year of college, my mother, as I say, reads the paper a lot. And one day I was home from school and in the arts section of the Birmingham News on the cover of the arts, you know, page, there was a photograph of a Black man with long dreads holding a skull, Yorick's skull. Mm-hmm. And it said underneath it, Adrian Lester starring in Hamlet at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And I saw that image and it really brought tears to my eyes because I think prior to that, I had never imagined that a Black person could play the title role in a play like that. You know what I mean? Like we had done Hamlet and I was Horatio, but I just had somehow like accepted that those characters, the title characters, you know, were meant for other people. And so my mother and my father put a little money together and rented me a car, and it was closing the following day. So I left that next morning, drove to Chicago, and sat in line in the theater waiting for a cancellation, got the last ticket. And at the beginning of the play, Adrian Lester came out and started to play with the To Be or Not to Be speech. And I sat there and wept like a baby because it really moved me, man. I think it was a real turning point.
Wow.
Yeah. So to answer your question, I guess, yeah, it's been a long process of me coming to believe that like I can have ownership over any of the parts in Shakespeare in the same way that other people have.
Right. When did you come to Richard II? What was the first time you read it, and what were your kind of first impressions of this play?
And I think the first time I read it was probably right after graduate school. Mm-hmm. I did a workshop of it with a group called the Shakespeare Society. And I was just blown away by the language.
It's amazing.
It's incredible, man. I think in all of for me, it's Shakespeare at his best. You know, those speeches that he gives Richard to say are profoundly beautiful. So that was my first contact with the play. And I think that last speech in the play, in the prison, Act 5, where I've been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world, that speech has really moved me. And I learned it, you know, during that workshop. And sometimes just walking down the street will just say it, you know, to myself. To me, it feels like in that speech, it's a man who's learning how to become a full human being. This man has gotten himself caught up in this world. He was born into this world, right? That it has all these expectations of him. And he does exactly what he's been taught to do, you know, and without a lot of guidance. You know, he doesn't have a father in the play that we know of. So he's this boy who's became king at a very young age and is trying to figure out what it means to be a man, right? What it means to be a leader. And he makes mistakes left and right. And it's not until the end of the play that he finds the time to be alone, to really sit with himself and reflect. And in doing so, he comes to understand that he is a human being. And before your eyes, you see a person become a person, you know?
Yeah.
So I always found it. I just found that speech to be deeply moving.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to hear how your approach to this, something that you've been waiting to perform and obviously thinking about it in terms of bodies and things to see and audiences in seats. What was your first thought when thinking, okay, we're going to do this in audio instead of on a stage?
Well, the first thought was, so I've always had a little bit of a resistance to the play. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because for me as a Black actor playing this part, I was concerned that me presenting a man who essentially is an ineffectual leader who gets overthrown by a much more popular young man, right? Mm-hmm. I was concerned that if the casting of the play, you know, for example, if the Bolingbroke character, the character who ends up taking over at the end, is a white man, that it might not look good. So casting an African-American woman to play Bolingbroke, I think, adds a layer of intrigue to the play and kind of shields that. But of course, when we're doing it on the radio, my first thought was, well, how are we going to translate that? Or is that something that we even need to be concerned about now? Yeah. You know what I mean? So that was the first thing. And then secondly, I would say there were all these ideas I had about the play and about the way that I wanted to play the character. When I've seen the play before, he's often presented as this guy who's just a bad dude, who's just clumsy and like arrogant and narcissistic and, you know, a bad leader. But I wanted to tell the story of a man who's doing the best that he can in a world that he just can't quite manage, right? Mm-hmm. But when you take that off the stage and put it onto radio, then it's difficult to convey that. So those are my concerns. But at the same time, the thing I was really interested in, as I said before, is that last speech, you know, and how we see this person really expose his own vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges I find with doing Shakespeare in places like the Delacorte or in these large theaters is that it's very difficult to play intimate, interior moments. So I think that this form will allow people to really hear the words and hear the complexity of the thoughts in a way that sometimes, you know, gets lost in the theaters.
Yeah. So you mentioned the sort of the difficulty of the dynamic between Richard and Bolingbroke in terms of race, in terms of power, in terms of all these interesting things, and how it then changed those dynamics for that person to be a Black woman, Miriam. How was it to work with her?
Playing with her, she comes to it so prepared. She had explored the text like thoroughly, so she knew exactly what she wanted to do. She doesn't do any of that, you know, fancy kind of highfalutin, you know, language that some people are accustomed to hearing with Shakespeare. She makes it her own. She puts it into her body and speaks it, and it sounds beautiful. And I think because she played in that way, you know, it forced me and everybody else also to kind of dig our heels in and come correct, as they say. So I think there was a bit of a kind of I won't say one-upmanship, but there was like a healthy kind of competition between the two of us, I would say. that we were, I mean, there are two characters who were like fighting for power, right? And so I think that there was a bit of that between she and I as well as actors, which I think helped. But it definitely made me feel much, much better to know that we had cast a woman of color in that part, because I think my worry was that there's a way of doing the play in which, you know, if you have a Black Richard and a white Bolingbroke, that you could be seen to be telling a story that Black people can't lead, or that there's a problem with Black leadership, and that only mm-hmm. it takes a white man to come back in and restore order. I think when we inhabit these parts, we have to always be cognizant of like the moment that we're in and like the stories that we're telling on top of the story itself. But when Miriam came in and smashed it, like that was out the window. It then was just about the play, you know, and these two people who are fighting for what they believe in, essentially.
The other stuff you're talking about, you know, the perception that casting creates, that just seems to me so, in some ways, like a double duty, right? That you're not just doing the play, you're thinking about the story that your presence is telling. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could call it a burden, you could call it a duty, you could call it just another intellectual challenge, but how does that live in your mind?
Man, that's a deep question, bro. I've thought about this a lot over the years and have gone through, I think, every version of it. I feel like there were times when I felt like it was a burden because I felt like, well, I just want to be able to do the play and, you know, just do my work as an actor.
Right.
But I think now what I feel is that it really is a privilege. You know, I've come to the point in my life where I'm really embracing my responsibility as an artist, because it is a responsibility. You know, mm-hmm. It's different, man. It's not just about, I want to be good and do this part because I like the part. No, like me getting on that stage in whatever play I'm in is a statement. It means something to somebody, you know what I mean? And I want to really take care of that. I think, you know, I remember when I was in school, man, I would look at these plays like Hamlet, like Shakespeare, for example, right? There would be, if you're going to do Hamlet, if you're going to have somebody Black, and it's going to be Horatio, mm-hmm. maybe Laertes. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe.
One of those, maybe. If you're going to do Romeo and Juliet, you're going to have Mercutio, probably could be Black. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Not Romeo, but Mercutio. You know, and on and on and on. Cherry Orchard, you know, Lopakhin, he's often played mm-hmm. as Black man. You know, the guy who comes back for his land and his inheritance because his father was a, you know, a servant. There were just these, you know, Sir, or Aaron the Moor, or, you know, Othello, or there were just these kind of like characters that I think like myself and other Black actors I know just sort of accepted, like, okay, well, these are the ones that are going to be available to us. I remember when I was in college and even in grad school, when people would say, oh, you're interested in Shakespeare, the first thing they say is, oh, you know, Othello, you know, have you played Othello? And for that reason, for a long time, I was like, man, I ain't never going to touch Othello. I don't want to, because everybody thinks that that's the only thing we can do, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. So when that opportunity came along to play the part, I was resistant to it at first. It definitely kicked my butt, that play and that part. But so in some ways, I think I accepted that for a long time as being true. Mm-hmm. But that's over, man. Like that's all that's changed now. Sometimes, right, the way that acting is taught in schools, you know, you do your research about the world of the play, you figure out what the character's motivations are, what the obstacles are, you know, what the things they're doing to move their life forward, all these things, right? But at a certain point, I've always found as a Black actor, if I'm the only Black actor in the Cherry Orchard, right? Or in, you know, whatever, an Ibsen play, at a certain point, I come to the place where I go, well, you know, what is the world of this play? Cherry Orchard takes place in Russia. So are we, how does this make sense, right? Conventional wisdom and the acting teachers will say, well, it's a play. And so nobody is going to see your color. Nobody cares. It's just, we're all just actors inhabiting this play.
Of course.
Except that after the play, all these people will come up to me and say, pull me in a corner and say, oh, you did a really nice job, but you know, there weren't really Black people in Russia at that time. Oh, it's so nice that they gave you this part, that they cast you in this part. It's really, you know, I mean, we know it's not really accurate, but little
you
things.
You sound like you've had hundreds of these.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these things, you know. And at the same time, like, we're American actors doing a Russian play, but for some reason, nobody ever questions the fact that these are American actors speaking English and like their accents from some from Minnesota, some from New York, some from Alabama. Nobody questions that, but like, when the Black dude's in the play, that's the thing that everybody sees. And yet we act like we don't see it when we want to, you know what I mean? when it comes to talking about it. So, I mean, I suppose it's like what it means to be Black in America, right? Like, you're always aware of where you fit in any particular room. And and you can either see that as a burden or you can see it as like a superpower. And I choose to see it as a superpower.
Andre Holland stars in Richard II, a collaboration between the Public Theater and WNYC. You can find the episodes at wnyc.org/Shakespeare. They're hosted by the New Yorker's theater critic, Vincent Cunningham, who spoke with Andre Holland. Thanks for listening, and please join us next time.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.